This is the Living Legacy Project at the Birchfield Penny Art Center, and I am here today with David Buck on March 18th, 2016. And Dave, thank you so much for coming in to meet with me this morning.
Nice to be here.
So the first question I ask in these interviews is, I'd like to pose two ways. Either what inspired you to want to be an artist, but also what inspired you to want to pursue a career in the arts, and sort of how those two aspects are related and different.
Okay, so I grew up in an artistic family. Mm-hmm. All my siblings were creative, wound up doing something in design, and I was the youngest, so I was just around art projects all the time, and just in an atmosphere, I guess I just look back and I think it was an amazing family to grow up in. It was an atmosphere where, like, independent thinking and creativity was encouraged and fostered. So it was always there, but I went into design and then into advertising, and I didn't consider myself a fine artist, so I'm kind of a late bloomer. Mm-hmm. I've been painting seriously since 2006, so I consider myself actually quite early in my career as a fine artist.
Can you speak to how perhaps your work working in advertising had creative elements? Like, were you a graphic designer, or were you doing more of the structure type stuff?
Yeah, so I think it could be best described as I've come full circle. That, you know, when I was young, I did a lot of art, and I went to Buff State for design. I went to art school in Boston, and then for commercial art, and then I started as an illustrator, and then I was a designer, and then I was an art director, and then I was a creative director, and then I owned an ad agency and did a lot of strategy and met with a lot of clients. Mm-hmm. And didn't do much creative. I'm still a creative director, and I still manage creative people, but the time to create was less and less and less. And so the expendable energy to create in the evening suddenly became more. Mm-hmm. Over time. Mm-hmm. I shouldn't say suddenly. Gradually became more. So then I found myself wanting to do art again. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of so it was really super liberating to get away from business and just go do whatever I wanted.
And so, yeah, I find that really fascinating, and also, you know, in this way that a lot of times I think a lot of people with creative energies are pushed towards different aspects of the business world, or they have to go into, you know, some sort of work to support themselves, of mm-hmm. course, you know.
Sure.
And a lot of times I see people who fall away from their own creative endeavors. It's kind of cool that you got to, like, find that later on, probably when you had more nights and weekends for you, right, when you're not
exactly
busting it quite so
hard.
Yeah,
the kids are out of the house, you know, the business is mature, and it's not as crazy as it used to be.
Yeah.
And again, you know, I wasn't scratching that itch during the day. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah, very cool.
Yeah,
awesome. So now you mentioned you did go to Buffalo State for design. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what years did you go to Buffalo State?
75 to 77.
Okay.
So I was, for some reason, I was really in a big hurry to grow up back then. So I had a really good experience here. I met my wife here, fell in love with Buffalo here because I wasn't from Buffalo. Mm. And I wound up just wanting to do more design. You know, I was really just getting to the good part of my you know, last 2 years, what would have been my last 2 years. So I actually, you know, went to a really specialized school in Boston called Vesper George. Mm. It doesn't exist anymore, but it was a great place. And got really focused. It was, you know, 8 hours of art every day.
That sounds awesome.
It was super intense, and it was really what I needed at the time.
And now, where was Vesper George?
In Boston.
Okay. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
What was the, if I can ask, so where did you grow up?
I grew up in a little town called Ontario, which is outside of Rochester.
Okay. And so what was Buffalo like in that era when you were here, and what was Buffalo State like in that era?
Yeah. Well, Buffalo State in Elmwood was awesome. Mm-hmm. You know, Buffalo overall was a little dicier. I think, you know, a little more of a mixed bag. But this neighborhood was, you know, fantastic. It was a really great place to go to college. You didn't need a car. And, you know, I just fell in love with this neighborhood. Michelle and I walked these streets and dreamed about having a house on Lincoln Parkway and, you know, went to the Japanese Garden and all of those things that are part of this neighborhood. It was great. some of my closest friends to this day I met during those years.
I love that you mentioned that, because that's very much my relationship as well. I grew up in Syracuse. I moved here in 2004 to go to Buffalo State. I spent a semester abroad studying with the Siena program. And when I was abroad, I would think about especially Forest and Elmwood. I don't know what it was. It was just like, yeah. It was just this walk that I did every day, you know? And so I could just like see it so clearly. And so I remember the night I got back, you know, after being away for the longest time, I'd been away from Buffalo at that point. Stashed my bag at a friend's house and just like walked the streets, and it was exactly how I had seen it in my mind, you know. And that was that's when I kind of knew that this was like home for me in this way.
Yeah. Well, this neighborhood's always been kind of the heart of it for me too.
Yes. And it's changed dramatically, certainly, within the past few years.
Yeah, this building being one of them.
This building existing.
Yeah.
We used to be in Rockwell Hall. It sounds like you were still going to school when the psychiatric center was active. Well, Richardson complex component of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I really loved a lot of the small local businesses that used to be right at Elmwood and Forest, you know, and how all that went down very poorly a number of years ago. But it was, what I loved about it was that it just made it feel like more a college town than the rest of the city did, you know, all these little businesses did.
Yeah, but Elmwood still has that feel.
Yeah. Hopefully for much longer.
I'm not worried about that.
That's good. That's good to hear. Speaking of your time here in Buffalo and maybe at Buffalo State and then also at Vesper George, were there people who were influential in your development there, you know, both not just in advertising but just as a creative mind and that sort of thing? Thinking about some of your more important influences.
Yeah. You know, there's been a lot of them because I'm old. my brother John was clearly my first and longest lasting influence. It's funny, he's 11 years older than me, and he just started doing fine art, which is really interesting because he's done a lot of things over his artistic career. But he was, he was a designer and then a photographer, and, you know, has done a lot of interesting things, and he's just always been my mentor and encouraged me from the youngest of ages right through till today. And so I have to say John first. As far as teachers here, you know, Jim Vello comes to mind. And I know we had that kites exhibition here in the hallway of the Birchfield not so long ago, but he was quite a character, but he was my drawing teacher. And Earl Wolfgruber was my design professor and advisor. So he was, they're both great people. I was only in Boston a year. And then, you know, when I started working, I've only had four jobs in this business. So, and the first three were all in like, you know, 6 years. So since then, I've been really kind of settled down professionally. Mm. But I've worked for great people. There was a guy named Bob Whiting that gave me my first job. A guy I freelanced with named Steve Moskowitz that really just great guy. Those are my Rochester guys. Mm-hmm. Strangely, I got recruited to come to Buffalo, you know, just out of the blue. And I said, Buffalo, yeah, I love Buffalo. So I wound up back in Buffalo really kind of by chance. And then I've been working for and with these guys named Crowley and Webb. The advertising agency is called Crowley Webb. That I got involved with when I was still in my 20s, you know, which is amazing to look back. I'll have been there 30 years when I'm leaving the agency as of the end of this year. So I won't be working full time. I'll be just freelancing, you know, consulting and doing some design for a more select list of clients, and having a lot more time to paint.
Yeah, that would be wonderful.
Yeah. So yeah. I know I kind of started answering your question and went off on three tangents.
That is exactly how I work.
Can't help it.
I was interested, you mentioned Earl Wolfgruber. So I don't know too much about it, but I know that I do have a photograph of him and Charles Birchfield.
Wow.
And actually, it's up on display in the galleries right now in the exhibition Finding Aid, Making Sense of the Charles E. Birchfield Archives, which is the first Birchfield show I've curated.
Good for you.
Yes, thank you very much. I'm very pleased with it. It was a very difficult show because it's all about context. It's all about the context we can learn from having Birchfield's archives here, you know, and so that's 25,000 sketches, that's 10,000 pages of his journals, thousands of pages of correspondence, his painting indexes, so we can go back and see not only what he painted what year, but also who he sold it to and where he painted it. It's an incredible resource. So I have a photo from, I believe, the Art Institute of Buffalo, from a class that Birchfield taught, and it's a photo of Earl working on the painting. And I only realized it was him at the time because Earl's daughters came in for a tour of the museum, and they came through the space as I was working on the show, and so I had them out, and they look and they go, oh, there's Dad, you know, and this way I'm like, okay,
how
great.
Nice.
Yeah. That's a really beautiful thing about the relationship that the Birchfield has with the community, and really how much a part of the community it is. You know, the people who are coming in here are the same people whose archives we're collecting, whose work we're collecting, and so in many ways I see the contrast between perhaps a larger institution or a more national or international mission, you know, where you don't necessarily meet the artists or the families of the artists of the work you're collecting, you know, which is, I think, much more the norm. And so being able to do something like this with these interviews and just, you know, call around town and be like, hi, do you want to come in next week?
Sure.
Feels so accessible. And so Earl was a design professor,
right,
as well.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. And my advisor.
Okay. I think he always sticks out in my head because what a great name, Wolf Gruber.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, oh, so cool.
He was a sweet guy.
Was he?
Mm-hmm. Very gentle and thoughtful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what was Jim Vola like?
He was a character. He got us out there like we would, like he would take the whole group of us to the bus station. We had to sketch live,
mm-mm,
like stuff like that. We'd mm-hmm get out there into the park and, you know, he just wanted everyone drawing every day,
mm-hmm,
sketchbook in hand, wherever you went.
Mm-hmm.
And just got you more like, you know, living like an artist and not just going to class and drawing. So he was, you know, he was definitely living that way. But, you know, he was very kind of brusque. He would, like, almost march around the perimeter of the life drawing class, for instance, and just be talking and gesturing. You know, he was an intense dude,
mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm,
but I had a lot of respect for him. Plus, his drawings were great.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like he embodied the, like, arts professor personality, you know. I wonder about that sometimes. Like, the people who wind up, especially in academia and being professors and stuff, take such a personality type in a lot of ways, you know, to be that dynamic. To me, it sounds exhausting, you know. And I'm a pretty energetic person myself.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I'm very energetic, but that just, yeah, sounds like too, like, hard to, unless that it just is you. I don't know how you can make that you every
day. Well, it was definitely him.
Yeah,
I don't think he was putting on airs.
That's awesome. One thing that, and this is going to speak to my age indifference. You know, sometimes when, like, I'm noticing as we're having these conversations that my first thought of creative advertising work and working in that way is thinking of computer design in this way that just absolutely did not exist when you were starting, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So what, if I can ask, like, what was being a graphic designer like,
mm-hmm,
working in advertising in the 80s,
mm-hmm,
you know, in that way that is, I think, very different than how a lot of people who listen to this will experience.
Yeah. I mean, you cannot overstate the changes that the communications business has gone through. But in that way, I feel like I am part of the luckiest generation because we learned every hand skill there was to learn. I mean, we used rapidograph pens and T-squares and triangles and, you know, something called Ruby Lith that you wouldn't even know what that is. You know, so we made art with our hands. We made layouts with our hands. We had to be able to draw typefaces like I could draw you 50, 60 typefaces pretty accurately. I mean, you had to learn that stuff, and you had to spec type. You had to know how long it was going to run. You would get your type back in galleys and paste it up. So everything was more difficult in hindsight, but, of course, it didn't seem that way at the time. It was just what you did. And I took a lot of pride in both my rough sketches and my layouts. You know, we'd call them comps,
mm-hmm,
comprehensive layouts. And, you know, that's how you sold your ideas. If you had a flair with the way you could draw and the way you could speak, then you had a lot better chance of selling your ideas than someone who maybe was more crude with their either visual or, you know, verbal delivery.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a big part of what we did, is just how do you communicate your ideas both internally and to clients. So I put a lot of effort into that, and that was my artwork for decades. You know, it was either you were good at that end of it, or you were good at the more like the technical end of it. And I was much better at layouts than doing technical, like rapidograph pen, you know, technical stuff. I didn't do mechanicals. I kind of skipped that. Mm-hmm. That was boring. I got to do more layouts and stuff, and I had fun with it. But that's how I broke into the business, you know, at a young age. And I also, you know, I was freelancing at 16, 17, 18 for professionals, mm-hmm. because my brother was in the business. So I think that's why I was in a hurry to get out of school and get working. I had a portfolio going. I was ready.
Well, it sounds like you started moving into more of the client side base of it at the right time. You know, even if not for that, the field was going so computer based. You know?
Yeah, and of course now I work in computers every day and use Adobe Creative Suite. But I do think that people that can go back and forth with organic and computer skills, Brian Gernert's a good example of someone who works that way. You know, just have so much more of a repertoire than someone who's focused on one or the other.
Yes. I think it really shows.
Yeah. I think in Brian's case it really shows.
But yeah, absolutely in Brian's case. Well, now that we've talked about your art in the advertising field, can we talk about your art personally?
Yes.
Can we talk a little bit about what you create and why you create it? And we'll talk more about the technical aspects in a moment.
Okay, yeah. Well, I don't know why I've gravitated to this idea, but I've been basically doing the same idea since I started painting, and it's in using family photographs as source material. So I was, you know, because I learned to be an illustrator when I was younger, I always preferred to work from photographs. And I have an inexhaustible supply of images because I'm like the family archivist. I have thousands of images, and they're from every decade, you know, going back pretty close to 100 years. I have some stuff from the teens and 20s. So, yeah. So I think that by working with family images as source material, like, I'm, by nature, I'm emotionally connected to that image. You know, I'm not trying to infuse some emotion into it. It's like there already. So somebody in my family took that picture. I might have taken it. My dad might have taken it. My mom or my grandfather. And there's some part of my story or my family story in every image I undertake. So it's kind of, you know, hardwired in there.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's cool. And it's, so that's the basis. You know, that's one aspect of it. But the other aspect is, like, I like to explore, well, I also think, like, there's a look to older photographs that might be a little faded or have, like, sunspots, or the way different prints have borders and different eras of images that are like Polaroids. And I'm actually right now working from slides, which is a particularly inconvenient source material. You know, I'm actually projecting the slides, and then I'm capturing it with my iPhone, and then I'm printing it out, and then I'm working in the dark, and I'm doing all these crazy things. But I think that's all really cool. I'm actually working on, I know you won't get into that yet, but the themes of memory and, you know, obviously family connections and, you know, kind of life in the country, to, you know, road trips and picnics, and I don't know, there's images of my dad graduating from the naval school, and just all these things that were, some of them are momentous occasions, but most of them are just small moments and somebody wrestling in the yard or something like that. So it's really cool to reinterpret them and take a modern, like, twist on it. I feel free to deviate from them a lot. The earliest ones I did were tiny little black and whites that I invented the color, and I take things out and I rearrange things, and sometimes I combine things. So I don't feel limited by it. I just kind of use it as a jumping off point to try to capture the whatever feeling I'm getting out of that image. It might be a sweet nostalgic type moment, or it might be a somebody, I don't know, there's one of me at like age 3 running around a trailer or something. It must have been a camping trip. And, you know, I'm just a blur. So, like, that's a different kind of thing to try to interpret. And so I'm just trying to capture the emotion and revisit that moment in time.
Mm-hmm. It's beautiful and poignant focus, you know.
I think so.
And it also seems very natural, mm-hmm. you know, in this way. I think sometimes, especially what I've seen in some of, like, my artist friends is, you know, when you're looking for the theme you're going to work on for a series, you know, but when you're still trying to figure out what that is in certain ways. And it seems that kind of what I'm hearing from you is both you've that's a really explicit part of it, you know, the mm-hmm. underlying current, but then it's you get to put your creative sort of layering all over that and to change it, but from a very known place to begin with.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And that in some ways maybe allows you to focus more on the painterly qualities of it, you know, or the
exactly.
yeah, the display component of the composition.
I try to paint in this economy of strokes. Mm. Like if that's one way I judge whether a painting was successful, if it's underworked and it's fresh and you can almost see that there's only like 3-4 layers to that painting, but I got the gesture.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes I do a more like an actual painting where it's got a lot of layers and I spent more time on it. But that's not really my thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think my thing is to try to do it in as few strokes as possible,
mm-hmm.
even if it's a big painting.
That's wonderful. And another thing I know, so we touched on this earlier, but I'd mentioned before we were recording that I was trying to look up some images of your work and found a few images on your BSA site, but other than that, I have not seen much of your work, but I've heard how you know diverse your work is, and just about how you know how many works you've made, and that they're everywhere, and that people rave about them. And I think maybe part of that is, you know, again, as I'm hearing you describe, like the basis of your process, these family photographs could be anyone's. You know, like
yeah.
they're very accessible in that
yeah.
way, right? Like it's your narrative, but also it's something that speaks to so many people. And do you think that
I've heard that so many times.
Yeah.
And then everybody wants to give me their family photos and commission me to do some work. For the most part, I've resisted, but certainly made some exceptions and for some good friends. But, yeah, people do plug themselves into the equation when they see my paintings. It just happens all the time. I think there's a, you know, they are accessible. I've been told that many times. Getting back to the point you just made, I think there is definitely some irony in the fact that my art is, you know, I don't have a website, but I'm an owner of an ad agency of 80 people. We make websites every day. And I think, you know, next year when I'm not working full-time, that will be certainly on the list too. But I think somewhat inadvertently I've created somewhat of a mystery around my art because unless you go to Buffalo Art Studio, where you can see lots of my art,
mm-hmm.
That really is the place. But I have been pretty limited in my self-promotion.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. Well, and you're also from, I mean, quite honestly, you're from a place of privilege where you don't necessarily need to do that right now, right? You're still focusing in many ways on just the creation and your day job.
It's true, and I, you know, my output isn't that great because I'm a moonlight painter.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm working a lot right now because there's a show coming up.
And where is the show?
I'm happy to be part of Echo Art Fair this year. It's
wonderful.
In May.
Yeah.
And that's a high-profile gig, so I want to do my best. So I'm busy with that right now.
And and half the town.
Yeah.
Everybody is like, oh, my God.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I'm psyched for that. And that's happening and doing some bigger paintings right now.
Well, that's very exciting about Echo. Congratulations. You know, your work will totally... That's a good environment for it, too. You know, I think the sort of art fair in that way lends itself to works kind of like yours that are both a little more accessible, but at the same time, you know, clearly a fine work of art, you know.
Yeah, I'm really excited to be in the company of those people. There's some great artists in there, and there's more and more out-of-towners, so I think it's getting tougher to get in. So I was really pleased about that.
Mm-hmm.
The downside of that for me is the sitting around a booth for 2 days is just, it's just not my
thing.
The only time I've ever done it is Echo 2 years ago, and I didn't enjoy that part. So I'm going to invite a series of friends to either man the booth or hang out with me so I can just be, because it was just like too much for me last time.
Too much posturing.
Yeah. People just say weird things. And it's awkward.
Super weird. I know. It is really, and you're like, aha.
Yeah.
That's something I've worked a number of public service jobs and retail and food service and all of that. And it's
and I haven't.
Okay.
So,
see?
You know, I can't deal with the public.
Yep. And it's, I look back now on my jobs at those times and realize just how much I still use the skills I've developed. You know, being fake without feeling like I'm losing myself is a very important skill, you know, where I can just turn on the smile and, you know, and I'm not being fake right now. I am also very smiley, just so you know. But I'm naturally smiley and fake smiley. But
okay, good.
Yeah.
Good to know.
Yeah. Well, I think it's, I actually did catering for a number of years for Oliver's. And so I used to do catering even at this building. And the most important part of that I've learned is that when I'm carrying like a 40-pound box of records, I know how to carry it and like use my core muscles and like not pull my back the same way I would carry a tray of 12 meals, you know? And I think it is interesting how those skills come out in different ways. You've got different skills. I'd say you're doing just fine.
Oh, thanks.
Birchfield would be able to relate.
Yeah.
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 It was really difficult for him to sort of put on those faces as well.
Yeah.
There's a sweet little quote, not a funny little quote, that I found from one year that he had to go down to New York for a dinner at the Metropolitan Museum of Art. And so, big fancy dinner or something, some gala or something. And so he's seated at this table with a whole bunch of people and everyone, you know, black tie, all of it. And he's writing about it afterwards and just how bored he was and how he didn't want to engage with anyone. And he was just daydreaming and not paying attention to any of them and their silly conversations. And then the woman next to him turned to him and said, "Well, what do you think, Mr. Birchfield?" And he's totally caught off guard. And he's just like, He's like, "Yes, absolutely." To which she looked horrified because she had just asked him if she looks her age.
That's great.
It was super fun. So this is the fun thing of being the archivist with someone like Charles Birchfield, you know, because it just gives you so much to delve into.
That's funny, yeah. Well, I would actually enjoy the dinner party, you know, because being around interesting people and interesting conversation and small groups is fine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, art fair.
And anyone can just walk up and assume your time in that way is difficult.
Yeah.
Are you exhibiting with a gallery or with a group of people or?
Just individually.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Congratulations on that.
Yeah.
I'm sorry you don't have a gallerist to sit there for you.
Yeah, me too.
The next question, actually, I feel like we've kind of already touched on, but I'd like to ask you if there's any more you'd like to add, which is about the totality of your body of work and what are some themes that have emerged. And so given like your focus, and I think we have touched on that. But
Yeah, like I said, there's plenty of exceptions. I've probably managed to put out, I'm an archivist by nature, and that's part of my process, is probably worth mentioning. So my studio space is actually full of stuff from, I grew up in a kind of a special house. It was an 1836 cobblestone on a country road with a lot of land and a big maple trees along the road and a split rail fence and a lot of space and a barn and fields and all of this stuff. And, I had three brothers and a sister. And so it was a big and kind of busy, active place. And my mom and dad actually both did a little art as well. I've mentioned my brothers. My sister was more like into crafts, but my brothers were making a lot of art. And so there was just always stuff around, and I have all that stuff. In addition to all the images from the family and previous generations, I have everybody's art equipment, and I actually just did a whole series of paintings that were on old canvas boards that I painted over some of the lesser efforts of my predecessors in the family, like just half done paintings and things that didn't come out very well. Then some of them I sanded down, and others I just painted over. But they were like cool looking canvas boards that had really cool graphics on the back from the art store that were like rubber stamps. And, you know, my grandfather made the tabouret in my space and the couch came from a friend, and it's just like it goes on and on. If you look around in space, there's crates from the barn and stuff like that. So I'm surrounded by that ephemera that was very related to my subject material. So that's just like one thing. And I'm constantly going through the images, sorting them into things that I think go well together, whether it's from the same era or whether it's a certain color palette or whether it's just a feeling. So there's part of the process is the archiving and the searching. And my mother labeled everything. I mean, there's like stickers on the bottom of antiques. She was an incredible archivist. Mm. And so, you know, I know tons about my family for 7-8 generations back. And
wow.
Who people were. This guy met Abe Lincoln. And it goes on and on. So it's really made it really interesting. And I'm carrying on in her tradition, clearly. My siblings all think I'm nuts, for doing it. Anyways, so that's part of the process. And I don't even remember what the question was anymore.
Oh, that's great. We've actually hit on both of them, because the next question as well is, what is, talk about your creative process. And so I'm hearing
okay,
a little bit of that.
Okay, so I can just keep rolling?
Well, I'd like to ask you a question, actually.
Okay.
So as the archivist, you know, hearing all of this is so fascinating to me, and like really exciting to hear how you as a part of a family is the family archivist, but also mm-hmm. using that archival material in your own work.
Exactly.
You know? One thing that's very interesting that I celebrate Birchfield for, and a number of other artists, is for Birchfield, how he created and preserved his own order to his materials, you know, and so he grouped different sketches by folders based mm-hmm. on the content, based on, yeah, the theme or motif or whatever, and so we preserve that original order, and we keep things foldered based in a similar fashion to how he did it, you
cool.
know, and so this is like the foundational concept of archives, from sort of where I'm coming from, which is you preserve the original order if it's there, because there's so much you can learn from the contexts that papers are next to each other in, or materials or whatever. Mm-hmm. And so what I'm kind of hearing from you is that you're taking, I don't think original order maybe exists in this context where things have been moved from person to person and different people are going through them, but you are part of the creator because you are part of the family, you know, so...
Yeah.
You really can't destroy the original order because you're part of what's making the thing itself, you know?
That makes sense.
Does that kind of...
I think so.
Yeah. I'm kind of getting it. I'm getting into some fun archival concepts I'm hearing in your work. But you're essentially continuously looking at the objects created by your family, and you are still assembling them and putting them in ways that create different contexts.
Yeah, I think it's really cool. Like, if you think about a photograph as just a... And a lot of them are just snapshots of seemingly inconsequential moments of, you know, a slice of life. And you revisit that, you just have the opportunity to put a whole new spin on it.
Yeah.
And then put it together with others.
Mm-hmm.
And then collectively they make a whole other emotion and feeling that you can experience in a show.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, I like that whole idea a whole lot.
Yeah.
You know, so... Sure, something happened, you know, 30 years ago, or 5 years ago, or 50 years ago, and you know, you've gone back in and you've created a whole like new take on it, and it's through the lens of, you know, personal experience, like right now. Like, I don't even know why I'm drawn to that image right now, but I am, right?
Yeah.
So, like last night, I was painting a hike on a hill, and it's a place I remember,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'm adding my own layer of memory onto, you know, in things I used to do with my brother, you know, onto that image,
mm-hmm.
in reinterpreting it in a new way.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
Go on.
No, I was going to say, hopefully it generates some kind of new feeling that's, so it just keeps going. It's kind of like a cycle.
Do you keep track of what photographs or materials you use in the creation of each piece? Like, do you have, like, files for yourself, or where, you know, you maybe have those printed out
on
your phone?
Yeah, I'm... yeah, my phone is a mess, because it goes from a, like, picture of what I did last night to a picture from 1932 or something, so it's pretty random if you just are flipping through my photo album. Yeah, I'm sorry, what was the question?
Oh, well, this is just me thinking. My question is, do you keep track of, like, what source material results
yes,
in which painting?
I actually, I do. I'm not, like, super systematic, but I have a lot of things I try to return to where I got them from, but there's some that I haven't that are more like a special collection of things that I may want to revisit. Mm-hmm. What I have done really religiously is I have a catalog and a format for, I have everything professionally digitized, and every time I finish a painting, it gets a number and it goes in the catalog, whether it's good or bad. And it's kind of, I just figure, you got to be brave. And that catalog sits in anybody can walk in there and look at every painting I've done. And some of them are pretty shitty.
But that's okay.
I know. That's my feeling is like, I wrote this on my wall in a late night something. It just says, everything is towards something. Because I feel like you can't expect yourself to do well or paint a masterpiece every night. So you just keep working. You just keep working, and you do the best you can, and then you put it out there, and you live with it.
And anyone who thinks that doesn't actually know how artists work. You know, like artists make, as people, as they're figuring out their process or a new technique, you know, you're experimenting. It's not all going to succeed, but it is still part of you and your whole over, you know, let's say a production. Mm-hmm. And that's a very interesting thing that I kind of get into a little bit with Tellus, my coworker, is the difference between the curatorial perspective and the archival perspective, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. From my perspective, I want the shitty paintings. Mm-hmm. From his perspective,
he wants the best of the best.
And he wants to make the narrative, you know, he wants to put them together in a interpreted context, you know? Yeah. I want it all raw as it was historically.
That's very interesting. I never thought about it.
Yeah, and that's a big thing that he and I go back and forth on, but certainly respect each other's views. I'll try not to ramble too much, but we've been processing, the largest collection I've worked on and continue to work on since starting is the Art Park Archive. So we now have the Archives of Art Park, which I can tell you about over a glass of wine sometime. But long story short, he was out with me processing the records on site one day, and so we're going through these old boxes of advertising inserts from the 80s, right? And it's just whatever they put in the playbills for each show, right? So we had these big boxes of them, just hundreds and hundreds, and we only needed 5 of each, but we needed them in labeled folders that said what original folder they came from and what order they were in and all that. And so it was very meticulous, time-consuming work for something that seemingly didn't have a lot of importance, you know? And so Tully and I are doing it, and he and I are very close friends. And so we're doing it, and he's like, this is... Why are we doing this? This is stupid. Why are we keeping all this stuff? Why are we keeping the advertising inserts from the 80s? And I'm like, Tully, just please, please just do it. You know, like, questioning is not where we're at right now. We're triage right now. And so we do it for a while. And then he's like, oh, look how much Hooker Chemical is advertising with Art Park in the 80s. Look at this. Look at all these, you know. And so he's starting to see a narrative from what we can tell about who's advertising at Art Park in the 80s, you know. And it's even more interesting now that I think about it, now that we've just found documentation of where the most concentrated chemical and toxic landfills are at Art Park now, too. That's a whole other level I'm just thinking about now. I saw a diagram yesterday we found. But so you know, it took him a while to kind of get to that point, but once he started finding something he could really chew on, I think from the archival perspective, it's much more that we do not know why researchers of the future are going to want those materials. So it's... We have to try and be systematic.
Just trust it. Just trust it and be thorough.
Right. So.
That's funny.
Yeah, but that's my fun little anecdote about Tully and I and our differences. You mentioned that, you know, you try to create a work with the least brush strokes possible. Can you talk a little bit more about that and what media you work in? And
yeah, so I work in oils and graphite. I usually have a base drawing, and usually that drawing is pretty minimal, although lately I've been working... pencil back into wet paint quite a lot, so that's kind of fun. So I guess in some cases it's mixed media, but it's basically oil painting. Although I've had many people say, oh, I like your watercolors, because I was a watercolorist and I learned how to do washes and that kind of thing and paint with immediacy, you know, back in the day. So I used to do that, like, I don't know, I was a vacation watercolorist. And I would do these quick things and sneak off from the family in the morning or in the evening and just, you know, go paint some landscape or something, or some boats in the water or something like that. So there's not very many of them, but I like doing them. And they're nice memories of trips. And that was basically, or once in a while I'd do a gift for somebody, you know, like a Christmas gift or something. But that's going back, you know, quite a ways. It's kind of the post-art school years. I did that for a while. And then I didn't do anything for quite a while. So at this point, when I started getting back into it, I found the perfect teacher in Rob Lynch at Buffalo Art Studio, who was teaching a Tuesday night intro to painting class, mostly for acrylics, but let me get in there with my oils. And I did not want to have anyone have a lot of influence over what I did. I just wanted, that was like Grandma Moses or something. I just wanted to see what would happen. Left, you know, unfettered and just let's see what happens in this grand experiment. And he was perfect for me in that way, and we've become really good friends. He doesn't have a prescribed methodology. It's like whatever you're doing, he just helps you do it better. And, oh, you should look at this book of, you know, Gerhard Richter or somebody, and this, like, you know, Fairfield Porter, you might be interested, you know, for you, and interesting for you. So, like, things like that. When you talked about influences before, and I talked about, you know, local and personal influences, I have to at some point today mention John Singer Sargent, because the guy I admire the most is John Singer Sargent. And I will circle back to actually answer your question eventually, because his gestural, like, buttery strokes are, in my mind, unparalleled. And he also did watercolors as well as oils. And, you know, I'll never be able to do a portrait of life-size, you know, a portrait of those kind of paintings he did. But when he did these, like, gestural things or some, you know, scene in an Italian, like, hallway that's kind of dark and just, you know, I don't know. He's done some, I've looked at a lot of Sargent's. Of course, I've mentioned I went to school in Boston where you can see a lot of them. I love that immediacy of, like, just hitting it and leaving it, and I love that. And I also love that you can look at some of his paintings. There's a famous one called The Daughters of Edward Boyd. It's a good example of some of that is so rough and gestural, and some of it is so tight, and it's seamless in between, and it's like, that's kind of like a photograph, because part of it's in focus and part of it isn't. And, you know, so I have yet to master that, but I think it's really neat when, like, the edges of your painting, I like to kind of leave clues as to, like, what that bottom layer looked like, and then what that other layers look like, and then what I really work on, where I want your eye to go, and the center of interest of that painting. And that's, you know, inspired by Sargent. Now, I'm not trying to say I can paint like John Singer Sargent, because I never will be able to, but I'm inspired by him, and I also don't have the education, and I never learned his methodology, so of course they won't look like his. Mm-hmm. I invented my own methodology because I really didn't have a fine art education. I've taken a few classes, and that's it. I just do my own thing. So now I'll answer your question, which is about how do I paint? And I like to start with a very gestural drawing, because, again, I'm trying to keep some immediacy and some energy in that to it. Sometimes I project and do some amount of tracing. A lot of times that is more just like reference points, like the horizon line's going to be here, and that's the size of the boy's head or something like that. But I don't like to draw in the dark, and if I'm projecting, you can't really draw well. You're obliterating your own reference as you're putting your hand into the scene. I mean, it's just I sometimes project again to get like proportions right. But I like to then, just like if I'm working like from slides right now, I'll project it on just a neighboring whiteboard and put a lamp on my easel and then continue to draw. So there's a base drawing, but it's usually pretty minimal. And then almost invariably, I will just very watercolor-like take a big brush and just stain the board. Just let it drip. And I'll just start at the top. I might be upside down mm-hmm. on a horizon line or something and paint the sky first. But I just like to stain the board, and I love I use a lot of thinner. I love the textures, and it might not even be a color that is going to show up much in the final analysis, but it might be just a more interesting base color. So I like to just do that, and I love to work, you know, really just like thick, well, in some cases thin, in some cases thick, but just nice running color, and just spin the board around and see what happens. So that's just fun because it's, I can leave it in the final analysis, or I can cover it up, but I'm going to get some interesting textures and stuff. Yeah, and then when that's like, a lot of times I'll just do that and leave it and come back another day and paint, or I might paint into that wet a little bit if I want it to meld, if I want it to run into each other. Mm-hmm. But I try to, and I'll tell you what, this is why I work in oils and not watercolor, and frankly I don't know anything about acrylic, so I won't speak to it. But it's so forgiving. If I don't like something, I can just wipe it off, you know, and I can keep screwing around with it, you know, till I'm happy with it. And, you know, you're never happy with it, but happy enough to move on, I guess, or call it done, which is another question. So I do try to make each layer interesting, and if I'm not happy with something, I've learned to be patient with it and just paint it later. Fix it later. Let it dry. If I'm going to do the more difficult or something that I really want some immediacy on, I've learned to just let it dry, go work on something else so that I can be super bold and come back another day and paint that face in three, four, maybe 10 strokes, and I'll like it, wipe it off, and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So that has taken some learning, you know, some growing pains to learn to have that discipline, because it's the way I work is not terribly disciplined. I'm like, literally, paint is flying around. When I get to the studio, I'm always like pacing and cleaning and rearranging and shit. It takes me 2 hours to get started, and then I paint in a flurry. So it's, I don't know why that happens. It just happens. I can't walk in and start painting.
Gotta get yourself in that headspace.
I don't know. Right? Yeah, it takes me a while. It's very rare that I can just start. But then once I get going, I usually paint until I'm just utterly exhausted.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'll leave there at 1 or 2 in the morning, and I just can barely walk. And so I'm always cleaning my brushes at midnight, you know, super, super tired. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that's my process.
It sounds really satisfying.
Yeah, I think so. Well, it is totally satisfying for me.
And I liked you hearing about how you lay down, like, the first layers and stuff like that, and even just the way you talk about applying paint to the canvas. Like, clearly the enjoyment of that, of the physical act of painting, is, like, such a present part for you.
Right.
You know, that you've been returning to since 2006.
Yeah, and it's funny because I've been asked to do, like, part of some of these events where you're painting and groups and people are there, like, at hall walls and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I'm not a performance painter. I could maybe do a drawing, but it would be hard for me to even imagine working with a model. Like, I work alone, and I think I would be too self-conscious to do it,
mm-hmm.
You know?
Yep.
And my process is so random that it'd be weird for anyone to watch me.
Yep.
Like, I don't do workshops, I don't teach, I don't really have a method.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just kind of left to my own devices, mm-hmm. and see what happens. Experimental.
It would be cool if you just set up a camera, though, to record you through long enough that you forget it's there, right?
So it would have to be long enough that I'd forget it's there.
Right, so recording you as you're cleaning your studio and all that sort of thing, through all of it, and then at a certain point, it just gets to capture, you know, spinning your canvas and, like, letting it drip and just
I suppose. But I almost think, if you look at the painting and you know anything about painting, you can see what I was. And I like that.
Yep. Yep.
You know, there's no, I'm not trying to be mysterious about it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And there's no need, I think sometimes, well, I guess it depends on where you are and your goals as an artist in some ways, like how much you put your whole process out there or how obscure it is in some ways. Yours sounds very clear in that regard.
Yeah.
It also sounds like you use oil kind of like watercolor some ways.
I totally do.
Yeah. That's what when you were talking about, like, the thin layers you apply and stuff like that.
Yeah. I guess that was natural because I had done a lot of watercolors, and that's just how I started.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, I've evolved. Like, I still like to leave the white of the board instead of painting white.
Mm-hmm.
That's a watercolor thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, no self-respecting watercolorist uses much white paint, if any. But I can go back in. So now it's a hybrid, though, because then I, after that's done, I go right to you know, painting thin to thick, and I paint darks first, and then I lay in some basic midtones, and, you know, so it's definitely a hybrid. Mm-hmm. That kind of stuff is more like an oil painter would do. And, you know, some of my paintings, there's large areas of completely unpainted, like just the white of the board. Mm-hmm. And because I paint forcefully, I do like to work on Masonite. Canvas is too bouncy for me. So I've used some canvas boards, again, because they were there. But mostly I cut up Masonite, and that's it. Mm-hmm. And when I first bought my supplies, I bought a lot of beautiful, soft brushes, and I never use them. I use these bristly, stiff brushes so that I can paint hard.
Yeah. And just the physical, it's a different kind of action painting, mm-hmm. you know, right? It's like,
yeah. It is, totally, and I'm trying to get a bigger studio so I can paint bigger, because my first paintings were literally 8 by 10 inches, and then I was doing a lot of little paintings. And Rob Lynch encouraged me to go bigger. So like this latest series is 30 by 24. Mm-hmm. It feels a little big for me. Like, I don't know. But the other kind of, one of the rules of thumb is, you know, use the biggest brush possible. You know, for what you're doing, you don't get fussy. You're like, you're just laying it on in a wide swath and letting it go. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. It's fun.
That sounds like an awesome process.
Yeah.
It does sound really.
I don't think I've done two paintings exactly with the exact same process yet. So mm-hmm. I really do allow myself to just go with whatever instincts, you know, I have at the time.
Mm-hmm. My next question is a little. It's a little cheesy sometimes, you know, but I do like to put it out there because I do want to hear what comes back, which is, what do you hope to achieve with your art?
I honestly don't know is the honest answer to that question. I am not a deep conceptual artist. I am not trying to change the world. The feelings that my paintings would normally evoke from people are, you know, not dramatic and sweeping and that kind of thing. It's really more just everyday life and relationships and emotions and memories and that kind of thing. And I guess that's why it is accessible. They're not difficult to understand. And so in that regard, you know, when you look about getting back to your question of what I'm hoping to, you know, accomplish or leave behind with it is, I don't know. I don't have grand plans. I'm just trying to make art that satisfies myself. That's the real answer to that. Mm-hmm. And I have found that, you know, people react to it, and it's nice. I won't say that I don't care what people think, because I do. You know, I need, like a lot of creative people, I need feedback, and I need encouragement and support. And Buffalo is awesome in that regard. When I made my first forays into, you know, exhibiting and getting serious about art, which again has only been the last few years, I had a lot of trepidation because I was a designer and I was an advertising guy, and I just thought, oh, I almost thought I would. In the beginning, I considered using a different name. You know what I mean? Because it's a different persona, if you will, and. I'm glad I didn't, because I thought the fine art community would be rather standoffish about some, you know, graphic designer making, and nobody cares at all. I mean, maybe somebody does, but I haven't met them. The people have been so welcoming and so supportive from every angle. I think it was really wise of me to join Buffalo Art Studio, because I get a lot of exposure. It's made me part of a community, so I haven't had to try very hard. And it's given me some credibility to, mm-hmm. you know, with the galleries and stuff. So I have found the transition remarkably easy. Mm. But it's something I was super worried about in the beginning. And I don't, looking back, it's silly.
Absolutely. I mean, your point of, you know, your context within the whole changed, mm-hmm. right? It sounds like you were still definitely a part of the arts community before you were painting. And you were on the board, yeah. and the council here, and very involved. But
and that's funny, because I have to tell the story, because I actually started at Buffalo Art Studio on the board.
Ah, before were painting?
Oh, yeah. So I was on the board, and I was helping them with marketing, and, you know, certainly very comfortable around the people, but I did not consider myself one of them. I was just an advisor. And then after several years, I had the temerity to take a class. I took a class. Then I took the class again, and it was Rob Litch's class, and I took it like 7 times in a row. So it met 3 times a year, you know, 3 sessions a year. So and only after that did I get a studio, and only after that did I have an exhibition. So I had a lot of fear, or just lack of confidence, I guess I would say, to start making art. So, you know, it's funny how, and then I got involved with the Birchfield again through the board first. Mm-hmm. So I like to start at the top and work my way down. It's funny. Because now I've agreed to do a salon at the Birchfield. Just the other day I agreed to come in and talk to the watercolor group with Kathy Shiroki mm-hmm. some evening this summer. Mm-hmm. So as an artist in the Birchfield, which is like, whoa, that actually still makes me nervous just thinking about it.
But, you know, this big fancy building
yeah.
is in some ways its own facade.
Yeah.
You know, we're still, and that's something that's so important for me to remember, and something that I'm so grateful that I had my experiences in Rockwell, you know, and know those roots, because big fancy building aside, we're this, I want to believe that we are still so focused on community engagement and being part of, not above, the community, you know,
yeah.
is really important to me.
Yeah. This place interacts with so many groups on so many levels. It's, you can't even capture it, like Toji is in marketing, but you can't capture it in a brochure or a poster or even a website.
No.
It's a very complex and dynamic organization, and it's just got to experience it.
Yeah, and I think that what's also awesome is how accessible our inner workings are to a lot of people. You know,
yeah.
So I manage most of the interns in the museum and have dramatically grown the internship program here.
Good for you.
To a point of it's a little too much right now. I think we've got like 7 interns and 3 work studies, you know, but we have 50 years worth of projects in the archives. You know, I've got endless rehousing projects for people to do. But I think the interns especially love it because, you know, everyone knows them. We take them around and introduce them. They're welcome in the spaces. They see the craziness. You know, they're pulled into the it doesn't matter if they're archives interns or not. They're pulled into the galleries when we're installing shows. And they even if I just say, sit here and listen to the curators talk about the layout, you know, as mm-hmm. Tullis and Scott are saying, well, should this go here? Should that go there?
Mm-hmm.
That was really fun with the Levy show.
That Levy show was amazing.
It was
I didn't even
amazing.
Know about that dude.
Really?
Yeah, but he's like a local John Singer sergeant.
Yes, he is.
So it was perfect for me.
We have one of his works up in our new archives corridor gallery that we've made, which is something that is so unique. Like, even the archives corridor gallery, you know, for years that hallway was kind of forgotten. It was just where the freight elevator was,
mm-hmm.
and we had the Rumsey freeze there, and there was archives at the end of the hallway. And just last summer, it was myself and our assistant preparator and our registrar and Tullis, and we're just standing in the hallway, and I'm like, why haven't we put art in here? Like, look at this. Why haven't we done that? And so we talked about what
colors
we
needed. There's never enough gallery space.
There's never enough gallery space, you know? And that is certainly one people's concern about this place, is that, you know, more gallery space. And to have dead hallway space like that. And so it was just the curatorial staff just stood in the hallway and decided what color to paint it. And then we decided the first show would sort of be an archive show. So I gave our curator and assistant preparator a list of artist names that we have significant collections of. They chose the works. I did the write-up, and they trained my interns on how to install the show. You know, so it was just like this super collaborative, just, but in a situation where we had enough agency and freedom to know that if we wanted to turn a hallway into a gallery, you know, we needed to get Scott's okay, but that we were going to do it, you know, and there wasn't any hoops to jump through. And I think that's a very unique experience here that harkens much more to local gallery, the way local galleries function, than, let's say, the Albright, in contrast, you know, that we can have big ideas and just make it happen, you know. So, but you can't put that in a marketing pamphlet at all.
No, it's a place that needs to be experienced. It really is.
Yeah, I know. But it also needs to be experienced not just for the art on the walls.
No.
You know?
Yeah, I totally agree.
Yeah.
So I know this is a legacy project, but I want to talk about the future for a second.
I would love it if you want to talk about the future, please.
So I was thinking that, you know, I mentioned how easy the transition was from the design world and the advertising world into the fine art for me. And looking back, I don't know why I was worried about it. But those worlds have been separate for me for these 10 years I've been painting. And what I'm looking forward to doing, so I'm walking away from my business after 30 years with the same company. And starting January 1st, I'm going to be able to spend a lot more time on my art, but what I'd like to do is bring my design and my art together. And I don't know exactly what that means yet, but as I've mentioned, all my art that I've done so far has been digitized, and I can do anything with those images. So that's exciting to think about. And what I haven't talked about much yet, I've alluded to my catalog. The other thing that's in the catalog, besides a record of the image and its stats, is the I've made a little commentary, a little story behind each one. And it might be one sentence or it might be five sentences, but they're short. But I put a lot of thought into what I write about. And I would really love to do a show that combines the writing and that's where the design comes in, designing the walls and designing the experience with the art. So because these paintings have stories, and my friends that come to the shows and stuff, they really like to hear the stories. Everybody wants to know, well, where was this? Who is that? What were you doing? Why is she holding a salad? I don't know. They're all quirky stories, but and a lot of times there's a larger story. Well, that was when my mom was sick or something. You know, so that's why she's sitting up there. You know, so like, I would really kind of been thinking about the larger picture of doing some cool paintings, yes, and a collection of them, yes, but putting them together in a space that would allow for some writing and some like cool design approach to the whole space that elevates the experience. So that's where I think I'm headed.
Again, from an archival perspective, like, that is just so good, you know. Like, and that
I hope
is
so.
Very much. And, you know, as we've been talking, like, you know, Charles Birchfield is, like, my best friend who died before I was born. And so I'm just, like, hearing so many sort of synergies with his process as well. And after this interview, I would love either to take you and show you the show or also show you some of his painting indexes, which sounds like you are being such a proactive artist in that regard in a way that is rare, but in a way that Birchfield also was proactive at a very different era. And so just hearing that link between, yeah, the context and the product and how you can even affect the way that is viewed visually in a space. I would say, too, it sounds like it would be a great book is another thought.
Well, I'm a print designer. So it was, you know, my favorite project I ever did was actually a book.
Yeah.
So there you go.
That sort of tangibility of it, you know.
That would be a blast.
Yeah, yeah. Something that people could take for that.
I've done a couple things that, one about my father's life and one about my mother's life, that actually are that. They're not printed books. They're big portfolios with each page designed with a painting on it and a story that, you know, I could share with you. They're in PDF form.
Yes.
But that's the closest thing I've done to what I was describing to you, where it kind of all comes together.
Mm-hmm.
And I put just as much work into the, you know, into the written word.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and just so you know, like, any exhibition materials you have, any postcards or stuff like that, or for this purpose of this exhibition,
mm-hmm.
you'll be sending us your most updated resume or artist
okay.
statement. But any materials going forward that you want to send us, we have, I think, about over 4,000 artist files on Western New York artists dating back to when the museum began. And both the files deal with historical figures as well. But, you know, that's something to get in the practice of just sending us anything you produce publicly. So these PDFs, We have digital artist files as well.
Yeah.
But we, our goal is to be the record of the creative arts in Western New York, you know, so, and, but that at this point is really on everyone to send us stuff as well, and we'll file it, you know.
That's awesome. I mean,
yeah.
I'm still finding out things about the center.
And yeah. And
right?
Well, a lot of these
I thought
things,
I knew you.
Yeah. A lot of these things have changed over time, even though the artist files certainly were started by Edna Lindemann and so are at the heart of everything. But I feel like it's time for maybe us to have a little handout, something that, like, you could take and put at Buffalo Art Studio that's just like, hey, everybody, you know.
Careful what you ask for.
Well, I know. That is the challenge, too, right? But yeah. At the same time, from the archival perspective of not necessarily putting my bias.
Not judging.
Right, right. Trying to be as objective as possible while acknowledging the subjective nature of reality.
Yeah.
So.
Better plan for the expansion now.
Yeah. We're, especially the archives. Yeah. I have taken over every square foot of space that I can find. Crate storage is now archival storage. Back hallway is just about mine. It's, yeah.
That's funny.
I'm not a colonialist, but I certainly put my flag in everything I can. That's so exciting about your future goals. And I just from what I hear about your process and your background in design and where your fine art is now, I can see that there's going to be something really phenomenal that comes from that.
I hope so.
Yeah. It's not really your... You're a little too established for this, but I'm very involved with the Buffalo Infringement Festival every summer, right? Which, do you know about infringement?
Sure.
So, talk about just a group of local creative weirdos trying to pull something off. You know, it's inherently non-hierarchical. Everything is volunteer and by donation. But we do have a visual arts component as well, which certainly is not, quite honestly, mostly people of your caliber. But the cool thing about infringement is that every proposal is accepted. And so it's good for people cutting their teeth. But also, like, if you're at a certain point and want to test something out, try something out, we would love to have.
Cool.
Yeah.
Thanks for the invite.
Yeah. I'll send you the proposal. Where it's very funny. It's a group of volunteers. My role, one of my partners is the street coordinator of infringement. So he coordinates pretty much all performances that are outdoors. And he's a violinist who busks himself and has gone from his time in Buffalo being the only busker to now being one of like 100 people who have been busking because of infringement. And so then in contrast, I've come on as being the cat herder. So it's my job to try and tell all the organizers, remind them of what they already agreed to do, you know, and kind of get everyone on the same page.
Good for you.
But it is like
sounds
herding
like
cats.
A tough job.
It is.
Yeah, you just have to roll with it.
Yeah.
Can't control it.
And I've certainly learned that while I'm not an artist myself, I, you know, have creative tendencies and they come out in different ways in my life, but I have a skill set that is very valuable for artists.
Yeah.
And it's that, you know, I can take, like, these big ideas that they have and, like, help them harness them into something that gets them closer to the goal that they want to get to, but they don't know how to get there.
Awesome.
You know? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure that is super valuable.
It's a little more like the paperwork side of it, you know,
mm-hmm.
like, I'll help you write a grant,
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. It's interesting knowing that's, like, my niche is,
yeah,
the paperwork side. Well, this kind of leads into sort of the next questions, but I think you actually just touched on this as well. This is what I love about these interviews. A lot of times we hit it.
Yeah, I'm so not disciplined about answering questions.
See, that's totally
I should run
fine.
For office.
Yeah.
We won't go
Let's
there.
Not incite violence. And I feel like you have spoken about what you've personally done to advance your career in the arts and how you sort of came into it from this late point.
Yeah. I mean, the first answer that comes to mind is I haven't done much. You know, I've been working away at Buffalo Art Studio at night, and a lot of times I don't even know a lot of the other artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was funny because when I started, it was like Annie Hoover was there and A.J. Fries was there and really great people. And, of course, you know, Kathy Sharon and folks that are still there. But as the place has turned over and we've gone through a couple of directors, we've had a lot of change in the last 5 years especially. You know, now I'm one of the senior guys. Like, I've been around there 10 years, which is funny. Like, I don't think of myself that way, but I kind of just came to the realization the other day. And I'm like, oh, yeah. They're looking at me as, like, one of the established guys.
Especially so, with Bill Cooper passing on.
Yeah,
recently.
Bill was awesome. Awesome.
Yes, he was.
Love his art. So, you know, so there's a new era there and a lot of good energy. And, and I think it's settled down into a kind of a new groove. And Alma Carrillo is awesome. And Shirley Verico is awesome. and Jane Hughes. So that's our core of our staff, our giant staff there. It's a good time to be there, and I don't, I've done very little in the way of self-promotion. I've pretty much had one show a year, and lately it hasn't even been that much. But it isn't, I haven't found it terribly challenging to find a place to exhibit. People are, there's a lot going on, and people are super welcoming, and there's always somebody wanting to collaborate or inviting you to do something. Like, I'm looking forward to next year when I can say yes more often and put a little, planning into where I'm going instead of just reacting and, oh, yeah, sure, I'll Olean Library, sure, sounds fun. I'll do that. Mm-hmm. Somebody just asks you to do something, you either do it or you don't do it. But you know what I mean? Like, I haven't been really mapping out any kind of path for myself. Mm-hmm. I've just been concentrating on the making and taking advantage of opportunities that come along. So it's just exactly what I don't do, you know, as far as in marketing for in branding and stuff, where you absolutely, you know, have a plan and execute the plan. I haven't been doing that at all.
It's probably really refreshing for you.
Just concentrate on making art.
Yeah.
If you can make yourself happy, then probably other people will like it, and it'll find its own level of exposure.
Well, you also do, I mean, admittedly, you know, I interview a lot of younger artists as well, and we talk about their challenges that they're facing too, you know. You do have this nice established relationship with much of the arts community.
I do.
Prior to being an artist, right?
Yeah.
And so, like, that kind of did sort of springboard you, in my opinion, in some ways to...
I don't know if it did or didn't, because I haven't traded on it.
Mm-hmm.
At all.
Mm.
You know what I mean? Like, the... I don't think I have. I certainly haven't consciously. And so I think maybe that will help me down the road.
Mm-hmm.
You know? Just like people just know who you are.
People, that's what I mean. Is people
so
like
you're
that.
Over that hump.
Right.
There's awareness. But a lot of people know me as something else than I am.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Which
so that could actually work against
it. It could be harder.
Like,
yeah.
Really? So that's interesting.
And the art scene can seem very intimidating when you're trying to break into it in a different way. And I used to have...
I suppose.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I used to have those same fears of, like... Yeah, I mean... Well, I don't know. It's a hard story. Whoever edits this, just take out this little story. But, you know, I used to date artists in the community. And some of them I was younger than, you know? And so very much having that relationship with the arts community of being, like... Oh, this is Dada's girlfriend. You know, and sort of like trying to establish myself in my own right and kind of coming in to this context and being very aware that I had to completely, like, break all their misconceptions of me as I was coming into this very established place.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It was. And it was never, everyone was always very nice, you know, but, and maybe it was my own fears of their perceptions.
Yeah. Well, so from my perspective, it could be like, oh, yeah, you know, this is Dave. He's a friend of this. Birchfields, he was a board member, you know, oh, he does paintings too?
Right.
It's like, am I getting some kind of break,
mm-hmm.
you know, or some kind of, you know, consideration because I've been generous with my time to the center?
Or is it
I don't want that.
Right.
I want to be judged on my own merits.
But I think it's more like, if somebody sees, like, a poster for your show, they're like, oh shit, Dave paints?
Yeah.
You know, in that way, that's more like people who already know you in this other context and be like, all right, we'll go support him at his show, even though we have no idea what to expect. And then
right.
get there, and then they see the caliber
of work. I think that's
happening.
Yeah.
I
think that part
does
help me.
I think that's more
Buffalo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, this kind of, again, we're doing great with, like, touching on these different components. But some of these last questions are intentional to help us at the Birchfield in some ways understand what the artist community needs that is not being provided in some ways. Not to say that we can necessarily provide it, but just to start those conversations. This project has grown out of an awareness that there are so many artists who deserve exhibition space in Buffalo and in this museum, but we don't necessarily have the time to do that. You
sure.
know, we, even with a new little gallery, we're still planning shows 2 to 5 years out, you know. So... what are the other things that the Birchfield can provide that artists need? And thus far, that's actually even materialized into, and you will be invited to them in the future, but about once a year, we had like a big dinner for all the artists. And so it's grown dramatically. We've only done it twice, but, like, you know, 50 artists now, we're going to practically have to rent the museum to do it. It's been at, like, Scott's House once and things like that.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would say you're doing an awful lot right. I honestly think, you know, I know the dual mission of the Birchfield Penny, both being about the art of Western New York and about the art of Charles Birchfield, mm-hmm. you know. And I think, you know, at some points in time, it was maybe more about Birchfield than Western New York. And I know the definition of Western New York is kind of up for grabs because, you know, people that may have been here for some time or whether it includes Rochester and that kind of thing is always an ongoing discussion. And I think, you know, thinking of it in a very inclusive way is how I always thought of it because it just opens up more possibilities for your exhibition ideas and your programming ideas. But all that being said is, you know, you can leave the artist of Western New York behind if you're not careful. Or especially because we have this, you know, gorgeous building and the stature of the institution has been going up and up and up to where it's a very significant, you know, cultural icon, if you will, and part of the landscape here in both a physical and metaphorical way. So we just have to make sure that we remain accessible to the, you know, new artists, marginal people who may want to dip a toe in the fine art waters like I did, who may feel, you know, put off by formality and, you know, glass and marble. But I do think those opportunities are there if you're looking for them. There's all kinds of stuff going on here that's super involving. I think if we think of ourselves as a place where the local artists, you know, hang out and casual things happen, that really not so much. It's more structured, and that's fine because it's still happening. It's happening in coffee shops, and I would compare it to Buffalo Art Studio. I'm very involved with Buffalo Art Studio, and I'm very involved with Birchfield, and they represent different things, and that's fine. You need both, man. You need the grunge of Buffalo Art Studio and having those events over there, and I think people feel a little more free to be the freaks that they are over there, which is fine. You know what I mean? It's been really awesome for me to be there. And just be part of things that are happening spontaneously. And Trimania, like something like that, I've helped plan the very first one. So that's become its own thing. Getting back to what the Birchfield can do, I think you're doing it. I really think you're doing it. There's so many people doing so many interesting projects here. It is like I just agreed to be part of the Salon with Kathy Scirocchi. I had to think it over a little bit because I'm like, oh, I don't know if I could do that. Like, in that space, would I be comfortable? I'm not a performance artist at all, and I'm not a teacher. So I agreed to do it because it was outside my comfort zone. I do that to myself all the time. But I think, you know, you just have to realize that along with the raised stature and profile of the Birchfield comes a certain, like, I don't know, would I walk in the Met in New York City and feel comfortable doing anything? No, I probably never would. You know, so, and the continuum of things, you know, we're not the humble little, you know, tucked away in Rockwell Hall place we used to be.
Yeah.
And so with that comes a responsibility and comes a certain amount of, you know, we have a more formal board and all the things that come with it. You know, there might be a downside to that as far as accessibility and perception.
I completely agree. And as someone, again, who, like, saw both sides of it, but is so rooted in this side, the accessibility factor certainly is what I think of most prominently. It's like, yeah, do people feel that we are the community gallery anymore, or are we, oh, the Birchfield, in that way?
Yeah.
And I think,
you know, like, I love to go to the gala, but that's not, like, a community event. That's an event for the donors, and that's awesome. I just think, you know, we could maybe do more community events that are just anybody feeling free to show up, and I don't know what that is exactly, but I think there's a lot of things going on at smaller scale. I'd like to see something a little more visible and large scale?
Well, the one thing, that, and that's very much been my focus as well, and certainly what is, again, what's so nice about, what's awesome, it's not just nice, it's like it's amazing about working here is we are so non-siloed mm-hmm. by department mm-hmm. that Don Metz has been pulling me more and more onto programming because I'm one of the people who is being like, let's look at our demographics here, you know, and let's try and be aware of the ways we, in which we do and don't represent the city. You know, do we represent the immigrant community of Buffalo? Has anyone there ever come in here? And what does that look like? And why would they come in here? You know, actually, they have. They came in. There was, we did have a, one of the naturalization ceremonies was here. And so that was a great way to get a lot of those people in. Cool. But has anyone come back? So just trying to be a little more pointed in making sure that we are talking about this, making sure that we are talking about the communities that don't come here and why is that in a way that is inclusive without being tokenizing
is my major focus.
It's got to
be real.
It's got to be real, right? And I think that in some ways that all these pieces can work very well together because Tony's focus very much is on national and international excellence, you know, and certainly we are moving in that direction dramatically. But the other side of it I see is like, well, that's going to come out of strong local works. You know, people are going to be excited nationally if they see us doing something really innovative with our communities, you know. And so that's kind of where I've been trying to push in those ways. But we'll see what happens with it. So we're down to our final two questions. But this has been a really wonderful interview. And
good,
thank you so much for coming in today.
My pleasure.
For where you are now, and acknowledging that, you know, you're in a place of relative, let's say, security in a lot of ways. You know, a lot of artists that I interview are like, are younger and are trying to both support themselves in a way that feels meaningful and also promote their art. But for where you are now as an artist, what would help you advance your artistic career? Like, what do you need to pull off what you want to pull off?
It's a difficult question for me because I haven't really defined goals for myself. I really honestly have been concentrating on just making art. I suppose, you know, you want to be successful at whatever you do and you want to share it with people, and I guess in a general sense I'm interested in greater exposure, and that might be beyond Western New York. It might be cool to, you know, if I let myself dream, to think about having a show in New York or someplace.
Mm-hmm.
So that's fun to think about. I don't know how to go about it because I haven't tried. So I guess that's one thing to think about, is just kind of greater exposure. But on the other hand, I don't think I'm really quite ready for that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that maybe that'll become a priority for me down the road when I feel like I have something really great to share.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very comfortable. The opportunities I've been given to exhibit, you know, locally. But, you know, I was thrilled to be asked to be part of the permanent collection here. So that hasn't happened yet, but it's in the works. And that gave me a great deal of satisfaction, I don't mind saying. You know, I think everybody that puts this much effort into something wants it to be worthwhile and something that is going to last after I'm gone, you know. So that was a very nice development. So that, I suppose I had admitted to myself that was a goal, and so that's happening. You know, I just want to make, I think I'm going to do maybe some more involved works, because I tend to just like really paint super fast and bang stuff out and leave it alone.
Mm-hmm.
So one way I described is having a more involved exhibition experience that adds layers to it, so that the art can still be immediate. But I'd like to try so a 20-foot painting. I don't know. Why not, right? I'd like to try a more patient painting where at least part of the board is, you know, worked on to a much greater degree, and see what happens with that. You know, maybe and then it'd be more impressive.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Experimentation.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't have a grand plan, and I don't have, you know, I'm just gonna, I think, again, like a musician or something, if you just concentrate on the making, you know, just let the other stuff come to you. You won't drive yourself crazy.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. Very true. So this last question, kind of like the first question, I ask two ways because it's really inaccessible for some people, one way versus the other. So the way it's written is, what advice do you have for emerging artists?
Yeah.
But for some people, that's too much, because they don't know who that you're talking to. The void. You're not talking to a person, right? And so what the other way I say that is, what advice would you give yourself when you were 20 years old, if you could?
Yeah. Well, I consider myself an emerging artist. And so my fine art age is, I'm still a novice. If you think I've been, if you realize I've been painting 10 years and I've been painting very part-time, it's more like I've been painting like 2 years. Mm-hmm. So I'm an emerging artist, honestly. I mean, I find 1, 2, 3, 4 nights a month I can paint. I'm super busy. I'm just living, I've been living a dual life. And some, you know, if I had an exhibition coming up, then I would find time to paint. And otherwise, it was pretty scattered. Which doesn't, it's not good. I mean, you don't have a lot of continuity. You're trying to pick up on something, I don't know, what I was feeling a month ago, and I'm back in the studio. So it's been difficult to get this far. But I guess I'm happy that I've stuck with it. Paying rent helps. Like, okay, I'm paying rent at that studio. I better get over there and paint, otherwise it's stupid.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a very practical type approach to things. But it does enter into it. So, you know, you kind of have to look for those overlapping circles of opportunity and desire, because sometimes you have the time, you just don't feel like it. And other times you really wish you could get there and you just can't. You know, that's been my life for the last few years. The first, out of these 10 years, I would say the first 5, I wasn't really doing too much. I was learning and taking classes and not producing very much. In the last 5 years, I definitely cranked it up. I think starting in probably 2008, so let's say that 8 years. Because I had a big show with 40 paintings in it, and I really worked. But it was crazy. I was literally living a double life. I was coming home from work, having dinner, and going to work on paintings. And I was doing it night after night after night. And I just, you know, I wanted to make the show as good as I could. So if, as far as advice for emerging artists, you know, I'm going to restate something I've said probably 3 times already, which is just concentrate on the making of the art. That I, at least in my experience, and I don't think it's because I'm known as a designer or known as something else in town, I don't think the opportunities to exhibit if you're making interesting art is all that difficult in this town. I really don't. I haven't found that. People have been super welcoming and supportive, and let's do a collaboration. And I don't know. I think the galleries are looking for good stuff. And if you're making good stuff, it won't be hard.
Mm, wonderful.
It's a great town to be making art in, that's the
really
observation,
is.
Really.
Yeah, it is very
It's not super expensive. It's super welcoming. There's not a lot of, you know, bullshit going on. It's really great. It's people of all ages and all mediums and, you know, endlessly interesting.
You're going to run into so many different people at an opening.
I know.
You know.
It's great.
Yeah.
Then there's the people, like, just come to eat cheese or something.
That happens here a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
It's funny. Yeah. I'm like, I saw her at the last opening.
Oh, she's not looking at any art. Well, Dave, those are all of my questions. Is there anything else you'd like to add before we conclude the interview?
No, this has been great, and I hope I said something interesting.
You certainly have. This has been, especially for me, like, this has been a really engaging conversation, and I've really enjoyed talking about the depth of your work and how you create it and all of that, and it's just, like, yeah, it's super fascinating to me. So.
Great. You know, I'm one of those people that, if we did this again a month later, I'd probably say a bunch of different things, because I'm just not a... I don't think about it a lot. I have trouble with when it's like, give me your artist statement. I'm like, oh. You know, I'm not a highly conceptual, super analytical person.
Mm-hmm.
I'm trying to just make spontaneous art, and the way I talk about it is usually pretty spontaneous too. So, you know, I'm just not that type of person.
No.
You know, so if, like I said, if you interview me next week, I'd probably say a bunch of different things, but that's the snapshot in time.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Thank you.